coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. The debate over whether to reopen schools this fall, and if you do, how to make it work, is heating up across the country and here in the first state.
Within our state's education community, I think I can express the consensus rather succinctly. Don't do it quickly, but do it safely.
Contributor Larry Nagengast examines where school reopening plans stand in Delaware. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also bring you an interview from our collaboration with the Delaware State News, Building Bridges, conversations with Delawareans working in the community on social justice and furthering racial equality. And we sit down with the CEO of The Moors to talk about how COVID-19 has changed the way it operates. It's all next on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Most years, July offers schools and educators a bit of a break before having to think about the next school year. But that is not the case this year. After finishing the last school year with 3 months of distance learning because of the COVID-19 pandemic, the task at hand is figuring out what learning will look like this coming year. Can school buildings reopen? And even if they can, how do they balance learning and safety? Schools will get some direction from the state soon. Education Secretary Susan Bunting is scheduled to offer recommendations created by three working groups next week. This week, contributor Larry Nagengast takes a closer look at what these recommendations may look like and the challenges districts and charters face even with that guidance. His piece is available at DelawarePublic.org, and he joined me this week to discuss what he found. Let's start with some larger context. President Trump says he wants schools to open this fall. The American Academy of Pediatrics recommends reopening, saying there are health concerns associated with distance learning, but has said that local governments and local health officials should have a say in this. On the other side, a recent survey found 94% of school superintendents aren't ready to announce when they are going to reopen classrooms for the upcoming school year. And apparently the CDC is going to issue some revised guidance on opening schools next week. There's a lot going on here, Larry. Is it fair to say that this is the same type of, I don't know if tension's the right word, or just kind of confusion, uncertainty that is playing out here in the first state as well?
Yeah, I would say probably more confusion and uncertainty than tension. The state's education community is certainly striving to get its reopening plans ready, just as all this pressure is building at the federal level. As you said, President Trump wants the schools to reopen. There was a parade of his advisors offering all sorts of reasons in support of that goal this week. Florida quickly announced that it will reopen its public schools next month, despite the ongoing coronavirus surge in that state. You know, make no mistake about it, returning to schools and opening them with something close to normal operations would be a very big positive. It would help parents get back to work. It would enable children to learn in a familiar environment. It would provide a tremendous emotional boost as well, and certainly all of that would be good for the economy. However, nationwide, there's a lot of concern about how to reopen schools safely when there are very few indications that the virus is slowing down. Current CDC guidelines, which may very well be revised in the next week or so, say that schools should not reopen unless there's a considerable decline in new infections. But exactly the opposite is happening in more than 40 states. Some epidemiologists fear that children could become silent spreaders of the virus. The National Education Association is skeptical of Trump's press for reopening. And, while Delaware is hardly a hot spot on the order of Florida, Texas, and Arizona, nevertheless, our residents were banned a few days ago for making non-essential trips to New York and New Jersey. And then Philadelphia added Delaware to its do not come list on Thursday. So, again, within our state's education community, I think I can express the consensus rather succinctly. Don't do it quickly, but do it safely.
And as I noted in the intro to this segment, the state is expected to weigh in with recommendations to guide districts and charters here. Can you give us kind of a thumbnail sketch of what the state will likely be offering them and how much those recommendations kind of hinge on when Delaware can move safely from phase 2 to phase 3 of reopening?
Well, okay. As you said, Secretary of Education Susan Bunting is expected to put out her recommendations next week. And pretty much everyone believes that what she's going to do is publish a summary of the recommendations that have been developed over the last month or so by the three working groups that have been studying the issue. The one thing that's likely to be a little bit new is that the Division of Public Health right now is tweaking the recommendations and, you know, making sure that everything that the Secretary of Education puts out are consistent with the state and federal health and wellness guidelines. You know, as for aligning the school reopening with the state's reopening plan, let me note that the working groups developed recommendations that were linked to three different scenarios, essentially one on if the virus gets worse than it is now, whether it stays about the same, or whether conditions improve. In essence, if it gets worse, we're going to wind up going back to the remote learning environment that we had in the spring. If it gets better, we may very well have a pretty normal reopening. But based on almost everyone that I talk to, if conditions remain pretty much like they are now, we are looking at some kind of a hybrid arrangement. That would mean that some children would be learning in school and others would be learning remotely, and the two groups would wind up switching back and forth for as long as that's the status that remains in effect.
Now, ultimately, the districts and charters have to make their own plans and execute them, despite whatever the state puts out as recommendations. Is there kind of a consensus forming on what approach should be taken broadly by individual districts and schools?
I'm not quite sure that we can say that. I mean, the state's recommendations will amount to an extensive guide as to what the 19 school districts and the 22 charter schools should do. But again, the state isn't telling the local school authorities how to do it. The how-to part of this planning is what comes next, and it's going to be done at the local level. Every school entity will encounter similar problems, but it's conceivable that we could have as many as 40 different solutions. Yeah, probably not going to have 40 different ones, but that's, you know, certainly within the realm of possibility. There are going to be tweaks from district to district, charter to charter, depending upon the school's capacities, any number of other situations that would make a particular charter or district unique.
The other element here is time. Will these schools and charters have enough time, 5 to 6 weeks, to put their specific plans in place and be ready to go end of August, start of September?
Well, not to be flippant with you, Tom, but the short answer is that's how much time they have, and they've got no choice but to be ready. Fortunately, many districts and charter schools have been working on this since June. Rather than wait for those state working groups to make their recommendations, the districts and charters, many of them anyway, have set up their own task forces, and they've already started to figure out how they might best operate under each of the scenarios. And, you know, what was going on here was that these working group meetings were all public. They were on YouTube, and all the minutes and so on have been posted. So it's been pretty easy for the people at the local level to follow along, see what the thinking is statewide, and start adapting it to their own circumstances. You know, the key here is whenever it is that Governor Carney announces how the schools should operate when they reopen. You know, it could come as early as next week, but the school leaders seem to think that the decision isn't likely to come until the end of the month. And that would give the schools 4 weeks or so to pull all the pieces together under whatever the chosen scenario is. You know, with the work that they've been doing already, that's probably enough time. However, we have learned along the way that we just don't know how the infection rate might change in the next month and a half, and any kind of significant changes in the status of coronavirus in the state is likely to have an impact on how the school's reopening plans are firmed up.
So what are some of the wild cards or challenges that schools and districts face as they kind of get to the devil in the details part of the planning of any kind of in-school learning?
We're looking at a lot of issues that, you know, things that we would really be taking for granted in a normal school year. Okay, now some families, no matter what happens with the coronavirus situation, may just not want their children to go inside a school building while that pandemic threat remains at whatever level. You know, some teachers and administrators might very well be considered high-risk individuals, and they would benefit from practicing social distancing even if the schools do open normally. So that would mean perhaps special or different assignments for them. Then, of course, will there be enough bus drivers? Now, pandemic or not, that's always a problem. But, you know, if you've got a hybrid reopening, are there going to be enough buses to carry roughly half of the students to school if they can only use every other seat on the bus? And then when you think of this hybrid reopening, you know, if you've got half the class learning in school and the other half learning remotely, how do you create a lesson plan that works for both groups? You know, and then how do you teach a first grader to read when she's at home watching you on her mother's cell phone? How do you teach first graders to stand in a straight line when they've got to be 6 feet apart? And, you know, maybe even worse than that, you know, how do you get dozens of ninth graders to follow the one-way arrows that are going to be marked in the hallways when they're changing classes?
And how much are districts and charters trying to take the temperature of families to see what they want and what they're willing to do?
I can't say that I spoke to enough people to give you a definite on how much type of response. But, you know, from listening to the working group meetings and talking to some of the school leaders, it's clear that many of them are taking surveys. You know, they're trying to find out what families liked or didn't like about distance learning in the spring. They're trying to determine what tech devices and internet access is available in just about everyone's home. And, you know, also you can count on definitely having more communication this year from schools to families. They're going to have to spell out the changed procedures for riding buses, different steps for dropping off and picking up children at school, details on how to access the online learning platforms, and most importantly, reminding parents that they're going to have an obligation to check their children's temperatures every morning and to be on the alert every day for any coronavirus symptoms that might pop up.
Of course, at some point, we always wind up when we talk about education getting down to money. And how much of a financial burden is this expected to be on schools, and what state and federal assistance may be available to help them create a new normal?
I can't say for sure how burdensome the finances are going to be, but I suspect that the hybrid operation would be the most costly. So many things will have to be rearranged. You know, there would be two different learning formats. Lunches would have to be delivered to some children's homes. Others might be eating in their classrooms rather than in the cafeteria, and they'll be using packaged meals and plastic utensils. And then you've got all those safety and sanitation items, the PPEs, the hand sanitizer, the cleaning supplies. Now, you know, we don't know how long the virus is going to be a concern, so education officials are going to have to make, well, what we would call educated guesses about spending priorities. Yep, there are going to be some federal funds available. We don't know how far they're going to stretch. In Delaware, that money right now is in two pots. You know, the larger pot has about $39 million in it, and that's been allocated to school districts and charters based on the formula that the federal government uses to determine eligibility for its Title I programs for low-income students. The second pot has about $8 million in it, and that's controlled by the governor. And he said the other day that he intends to award this money to districts and charters through a competitive grants process.
All right, I want to go back to something you alluded to earlier. In the end, this could all change on a dime, depending on how the pandemic plays out in coming months. How ready are schools for a quick pivot?
We really don't know. We're not going to know until that change is actually required. And I think that if we start the school year with the hybrid, it's going to be easier to make a shift either to a full opening or to an all-remote mode, rather than starting at either one of those extremes and then having to slip into the hybrid, which is the most confusing of the three to work with. And again, there, another thing to keep in mind is there are going to be situations where, maybe something as small as a single classroom could become a hot spot, and maybe then a school would decide, we've just got to shut down that class and quarantine the people in that classroom for a week or perhaps more, or maybe an issue in a classroom becomes something that's makes it necessary to shut down an entire school. Bottom line here is, the states and the schools are still doing their summer homework, and in another month they're going to know a lot better what they should be doing and have a better idea of how to get it done. What we don't know, however, is going to be how quickly they're going to have to pivot and which way they'll have to turn.
Thanks to contributor Larry Nightengast for his time this week. You can read his reporting on reopening first state schools this fall at DelawarePublic.org. And stay with us. We bring you the first of our contributions to Building Bridges, a collaborative series with the Delaware State News, profiling Delawareans working to advocate for social justice and racial equality. That's next on The Green here on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. This week, we bring you a piece of our latest collaboration with the Delaware State News, Building Bridges, conversations with Delawareans working in the community on social justice and furthering racial equality. These conversations come as calls for change intensify in every arena, from policing to education. One school district in Delaware, the Red Clay School District, has ramped up its work around equity in recent years, hiring the state's first district equity officer, and offering trainings by the ACLU on fair school discipline practices. And its board recently considered, but ultimately tossed out, the idea of removing school resource officers, or school police, from its buildings. In this Building Bridges conversation, Delaware Public Media's Sophia Schmidt talks with Red Clay Superintendent Darrell Green about his journey in the field of education and the role K-12 schools play in racial justice.
Why did you choose to go into education?
I actually chose to go into education as a result of a teacher in high school who saw something in me. Her name is Melanie Caldwell. She's since passed. But she was an advocate and someone who stood up for me and demonstrated just a love, a care, and concern for my well-being as a sophomore in high school in a way that no other educator had to that point. And she felt that there was something about me that would have made me, that education would have been a good process or career path for me. I had aspirations to play collegiate sports, and I was fortunate enough to get a choir scholarship to the University of Delaware. And because Ms. Caldwell kind of planted that seed that education would be a good path, knowing that there was a void of black male educators even at that time, and which is something that's still present day, I chose education as a career path or an option at that point, and realized that it was part of my destiny, I guess, to get an education.
So you mentioned you went to UD. You were a star football player there. The university was known, at least a while back, as not being the most welcoming to black students. So do you mind if I ask, what was your experience like there?
Yeah, I mean, I know the population of minorities and black students, definitely was underrepresented, and I think it's something that the university continues to try to strive to, promote diversity, get more black students on the campus. I think my experience was one that was unique in that I moved through a lot of spaces being an athlete, but I was also always conscious of, my blackness, and found myself to be one of few within my, areas of study and concentration being elementary teaching education. Primarily, my classmates were predominantly white female. And so, that was always kind of a conscious way that you had to kind of move and go about the campus. And, I think it's something that routinely plays out as we see in society today. What does it mean to be black in America, primarily a black male? And knowing that you move in spaces, and even to this day, being one of probably the only African-American black superintendent in Delaware at this time, that I find myself being the only one represented in the room often.
Mm-hmm. I do want to get your take on sort of this moment. Does it feel different? Does it feel like it could be a tipping point? One specific thing that happened recently, DOE is giving the Office of Innovation and Improvement, which you used to direct, a change, calling it the Office of Equity and Innovation. And, you know, certainly before these protests over the last month or so, there was sort of an increased focus on equity in education in Delaware. We have the education funding lawsuit going on. Do you feel like we're making progress in Delaware? And do you think this movement right now could be, you know, the push we need to make more progress on equity in education?
I think so. I think obviously, you know, serving and working and living in Red Clay, the fact that we have a Office of Equity, and I've since been in this role expanded into the Office of Equity and Strategic Partnerships, because it goes just beyond what a school or educational system can do. It takes a collective impact framework and effort as we look at our nonprofit partners, our philanthropic community, for-profit, you know, organizations and businesses, and then, you know, our families and representative communities as a whole to kind of come together to share in a space of empathy. And I think, you know, while it's folks have been, you know, emotions have been pricked by the kind of blatant visual of the unfortunate 8 minutes and 46 seconds that we all continue to relive. I mean, it's right here, right? And our young people who are energized and motivated, and, you know, another avenue that we have kind of expressed advocacy amongst Red Clay is really elevating student voice. And what better time now than to actually lean into it and engage our young people in a way as they continue to advocate and seek for a better today, and not simply waiting for, you know, tomorrow. And so any progress and the obviously the level of conversation and discourse, while it may not necessarily be comfortable, it's something that we have to go through. And I think this feels different, but I can't speak to, you know, a generation ago because I didn't live it. And I'm sure, you know, those who, you know, fought for and against injustice and for justice, you know, as they lived history and as we reflect on history, you know, maybe they did feel the same, and maybe they see this as progress, and maybe they don't. I think, you know, I tend to live by a quote that my experiences shape my biases, which leads to my actions. And so as we experience this, we're going to have to be conscious that obviously there are multiple perspectives. So how do we listen to those perspectives and kind of create a path so that we do see substantive change and not just rhetoric? And it's just not a statement that we're putting out to say that we believe, but how do we actually turn this into action so that our students, so that our families, and our community as a whole transition beyond, I think, the hurt that many are within our community is feeling, or the confusion through a lack of understanding, or, you know, unconscious or conscious biases that play out on a regular basis, that we can be intentional about, you know, developing a community, especially for our children, as an educational system can be as equitable as we aspire for it to be, and monitor that over time to really look at what are our goals as a community, as a district, so that, again, it's just not words or tolerance, you know, but we're actually doing this work for a deeper understanding, ensuring that, you know, again, we want to create a system where all children and all families in Red Clay can thrive.
So what are your, I don't want to necessarily make you pick like top priorities, but like in terms of concrete policies and practices that the state needs to be putting in place for educational equity, you know, what do you want to see next?
Well, I think back to just my days as a fourth grade teacher and would always teach Delaware history. And I was always fascinated in teaching it to our children, the lack of knowledge that people have even about Delaware history, but let alone our history as a nation. And so just from an initial, you know, kind of policy standpoint, it would be, and as an educational institution in the system, you know, really teaching, you know, not just Black history, but true American history. And some of that is painful, you know, especially as we, you know, remove monuments and understanding what many of those monuments and you know, statues and things, what they signify and what they represent. But it's also a means of educating, you know, all of us, you know, as a society on, you know, just the inherent system and structures that our country and our systems are built on, so that we can, as best we can, come from a equal understanding as to why there is a need for change. And so, you know, I think the divisive nature of where we find ourselves, it's easy to become tribal, you know, based on, you know, zip codes and socioeconomic status, where we live, to pit people against each other. And I think that's the biggest challenge for us in education is, you know, especially in Red Clay, so many of our families come from so many differing, you know, perspectives and viewpoints and life experiences. And then we have children who come into our schools where we have to try to engineer community, knowing that, you know, when that school day ends, they go back to a world that could be polar opposites, right? And it's, unless there's a shared experience, whether that would be through, you know, the arts, athletics, classroom-based instruction, you know, how much interaction beyond the school experience does our community generally have? And so I think really having a just some understanding of what our history is, you know, for us, we're looking at, you know, social justice standards and you know, throughout K-12. And, you know, that's just for all of our, you know, representative groups, whether that's, you know, your LGBTQ. And as I indicated, we have a lot of students and families who are English learners who are dealing with issues around immigration. You know, so we have to be attuned, you know, looking at the disproportionate impact around COVID. There are so many things that I think impact schools or actually happen out in communities that come into schools. You know, so how do we support our educators who get into this business to really make a difference and change the lives of students, to be culturally responsive in their teaching, you know, around text and information, you know, understanding, you know, how are we trauma invested so that we understand the needs of children who might come to school with underlying trauma, adverse childhood experiences. You know, so it's layered. And then obviously when we're talking about, you know, injustice and the various other things that we're confronted with in schools, how do we create a system that can, one, absorb the pressure to help the world change, but do that in a way where we keep people safe, healthy, and whole in that process of doing it, knowing that it's difficult work. You know, for us as a district, you know, we've leaned into this work, not just because of what's happening in the moment. I mean, you know, we have diversity champions, as you indicated, the Office of Equity. We've, you know, partnered with groups such as the ACLU this past year to really look at disproportionality in school discipline. You know, we are keen, you know, we have Dr. Sarah Celestin, who is the Director of Special Services, who oversees our special ed services. You know, really being attuned to, you know, the various, you know, subgroups and demographics that make up Red Clay, and really trying to be intentional about how do we meet the needs of each of those representative groups, but also being inclusive in our approach, understanding that we are, you know, a community. And when we say the Red Clay Consolidated School District, how do we not leave anyone out on the outside, not feeling welcomed, wanted, appreciated, loved, and getting back, I think, from my goal is the true essence of what schools and should represent, which is ultimately learning is that relationship between the student and the teacher. And anything that kind of creates or puts a wedge in between that becomes a distraction to us trying to build a healthy community. And so how can we continue to, you know, be attuned to the needs, but proactively put resources and supports in place so that we can create and live out those vision and mission statements that we have. This is difficult work. It's uncomfortable work, but it's necessary work nonetheless if we really truly believe that every child can learn, should learn, and more importantly, we're here to teach them and help them learn.
Red Clay Superintendent Darrell Green, thank you so much.
Thank you for your time.
Thanks, Sophia. And you can find a link to more conversations from our Building Bridges collaboration with the Delaware State News at DelawarePublic.org or at DelawareStateNews.net. And the Green continues in a moment with our conversation with Nemours CEO, Dr. Larry Moss. Stay with us. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. This week on The Green, I want to take a few moments to remember the life and legacy of Alan Ludell, who passed away this week. Our condolences to his wife, two children, and other family and friends. Most know Alan Ludell, the first state journalism icon, who brought intelligence, integrity, and boundless energy to news coverage in Delaware during his incredible and frankly, unmatched career at both WILM News Radio and WDEL. They don't make him like Alan Liddell anymore, and the state was fortunate to benefit from his talents for so long. But I knew Alan as a colleague and friend. I spent the majority of my 17 years at WILM News Radio working with Alan, largely sharing the morning shift with him anchoring and me handling sports. And even though he wasn't a sports guy, as a program director, he always supported my efforts to cover local Delaware sports and cover them well, which meant a lot to me. I have so many memories of Alan from those days at WILM, ones I've had a chance to share again with friends and former colleagues this week, and they bring a smile to my face. And that's how I'll remember Alan Liddell, for the joy and enthusiasm he brought to both his work and his life. We'll miss you, Alan. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Healthcare systems around the country, including here in Delaware, have been coping with the coronavirus pandemic for months now. And while the case level here in the first state has not taxed hospital capacity as it has elsewhere, healthcare systems here are navigating a number of issues and challenges. And we recently sat down with Nemours CEO, Dr. Larry Moss, to discuss some of those issues and challenges and some of the opportunities found in the new normal created by the pandemic. Let's start with the broad picture of the impact that COVID-19 has had on Nemours. Can you kind of quantify in broad terms what navigating this pandemic has been like for Nemours as a health system?
That's a big question, and I can answer that in a lot of ways. Let me start off with the human impact. Mm-hmm. So the human impact of the virus on kids from a health perspective has been fortunately mostly good news, and kids have been relatively but not completely spared the devastating effects of the virus. That's not true of pediatric institutions. So our staff and our caregivers and our associates have faced the same challenges, the same limitations, the same everything that you see in adult health systems. And so that's important to understand. And an interesting corollary to that is the financial implications, where a lot of folks have made the assumption that since the virus is relatively sparing of children, that children's hospitals are probably okay. And actually, the financial hit that we've taken is significantly more than adult hospitals in many respects. We've done the same reduction in service. We've invested the same amount in protecting our staff and PPE and altering our processes. And what the adult institutions are seeing a large influx of COVID patients. Well, that's tragic and something we wish didn't happen on a human level. It mitigates a lot of the revenue impact on the hospital. Children's hospitals had all the downside and none of the mitigation, essentially. And I've also, at least in the early stages of the federal response to the financial crisis that health institutions have faced, have been somewhat left out. Now, we're taking some steps to hopefully remedy that, and we've made some partial gains, but not all the way back. So I don't want to go to finances right away, but it's a distinction for people to realize.
Well, since you went there, let's just kind of quick cover that, and I'll ask, you know, what is the long-term, well, like short-term and long-term implications of that financial impact on Nemours in terms of what you're able to do, both in terms of caring for patients and also a lot of the other things that you do in terms of engaging the community?
It's not trivial. We are significantly behind our financial projections at this point, to the tune of ballpark $100 million, which is not chump change, right? And it's important. But I'll immediately follow that by saying we've got a plan to get through this, and Nemours is and will be here forever to take care of kids. So this is a short-term, maybe a blip is a too cavalier a word, but a short-term challenge that we will overcome and get through. How does this impact us? Well, let me turn that around, because I could cast a lot of doom and gloom about, oh, maybe we can't do this, maybe we can't do that. In reality, I think it's valuable to focus on the enormous opportunities that COVID has created for the entire U.S. health systems and health systems like Nemours. You know, I would venture to say, as terrible as COVID is and as much of a tragedy as it is, in the arc of history, perhaps more positives than negatives will come out of this, and I'd be happy to elaborate if you want me to.
Well, I was going
to
say, I'm assuming that one of those areas that you can see progress and opportunity in is in the area of telehealth and engaging patients and their families in that way. I mean, before the pandemic, telehealth was kind of getting a foothold in treatment. It seems like it's kind of taken a quantum leap in a very short period of time here during this pandemic. Is that a fair way to look at it, that it's kind of creating a sea change here in the way patients are engaged?
Great question, Tom. Yes and yes, and I will I'll give you a couple lenses on telehealth. The first, and just for the benefit of anyone who's not aware, telehealth is using digital technology to have a visit with a doctor, nurse, or provider. So you may be on your iPhone sitting at home. You may be in a location that's close to home, and your doctor or your caregiver is on the screen. Nemours has believed for some time that that has a very important role in the future of healthcare and in the future of the delivery of medical care. So we have invested very, very heavily in the technology and the infrastructure and support, and we've done that over the last several years. So we look like geniuses when COVID happened, maybe not so much because we're geniuses, but because we're thinking about the future. And so we went from across our organization 50 to 100 telehealth visits a week to 2 to 3,000 telehealth visits a week in 1 week. So that's a pretty big increase in 1 week. And it was massively successful from the provider's perspective, from the patient's perspective, from the family's perspective. So that is absolutely wonderful. And it's, you know, I think I used the terminology, and something I wrote about this recently is we made 10 years of progress in 10 days. And so huge benefit and huge learning opportunity. But the other lens I'd put on that, which is even more important, is we learned something about our health system and our health system's ability to respond. And when I say our health system, I'm not talking about Nemours. I'm talking about the system of health in the United States. Mm-hmm. And important changes like telehealth that we've been talking about for a decade and saying would take us decades and perhaps a generation to turn the aircraft carrier in that direction. No, we can do it in a week. And we've learned that we can be incredibly nimble and incredibly responsive very, very rapidly. And the sun still comes up every morning and the system still survives and thrives. And I would carry that analogy to Nemours' core agenda, which is changing the way we pay for children's health care in the United States to a system where the risk and the responsibility and the accountability is on us, the people who provide the care, instead of a third party.
I do want to get to that topic in just a moment, but I am curious. Well, two things I'm curious about. One, on telehealth, was that the slow progress more of a patient's kind of being resistant to it, or was it just a matter of health systems being slow to incorporate it and maybe, for lack of a better term, an unwillingness to kind of push the envelope on it until they had to?
The major barrier was self-imposed and was in our minds. And a big part of that's on health systems. And we needed to advance our thinking that this could happen and it could happen tomorrow, not in 10 years. But the patients aren't totally off the hook either. And I think just like this was a big wake-up call and learning experience for health delivery systems, it's a big wake-up call for patients and families. And you know, they're now saying, why did I think this was a bad idea last month and it's the best thing since sliced bread this month? So that's one aspect. There were some very real barriers from a regulatory point of view, and I'd break those into two categories. Reimbursement, you know, if you're going to deliver the same care from a telehealth perspective and get paid 20% as much, not a lot of incentive to do it.
Correct.
And interstate licensing barriers, where even though all physicians essentially meet the same standards, it's a radically different thing to get licensed in this state and then travel 5 miles and go through a license process in another state. I give the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, or CMS, in Washington a lot of credit, and Administrator Verma gets a lot of credit for wiping away those barriers in a matter of a couple of days. We've been debating it for years and the better part of a decade. So we also learned that these regulatory barriers are not really quite as complicated to eliminate as we thought.
Were there any other things that you've seen you know, in these few months that you've had to do differently that may be things that could be incorporated post-pandemic going on in terms of care, providing care?
Yeah, I mean, if you want me to list the things that we've learned and could you do, I mean, we can talk about this for the next 10 hours. A whole lot of things, from things that might sound fairly mundane to the way we make the schedules for nurses, respiratory therapists, and other key care providing individuals, where we used to be much more regimented about it. As we've allowed more and more flexibility and people to kind of create their own worlds, we found out that's actually better for them and better for us. So that's an interesting example. There's things in the way that we deal with partner hospitals and community providers that have changed radically. Even something as simple as the way we make daily rounds, we're very committed to the concept of family-centered multidisciplinary rounds. That's a lot of words, but it essentially means the whole team gets together at one point and gets in front of the family. So it means doctors, nurse, pharmacy, respiratory therapist, social worker, every aspect of the care team. Well, it's hard to do that in person. And so, you know, they corners got cut and sometimes part of the team was there and not all the team was there. Well, in a virtual environment, it's pretty darn easy to get everybody together at the same time and the families love it.
I want to circle back to something you kind of started to allude to earlier, and that is this concept of social determinants of health.
Yes.
And, you know, one of the things we've seen during this pandemic is that the disproportionate impacts of the virus on people of color. And I'm curious if that connects to this idea of social determinants of health. I mean, I know it's something we've reported on a bit. It's something you've talked about recently in relation to children's health. This idea of education, nutrition, security, all these things playing as big a role as anything in people's overall health. Does this kind of disproportionate impact of COVID-19 put a spotlight and maybe get a greater focus on this concept of social determinants of health and how important they are in terms of overall personal health?
Yeah. So Tom, we have known with hard evidence, not conjecture, that less than 20% of health is due to medical care. So this $3.5 trillion system that we call a healthcare system in the U.S., it's really a sickness care system, actually deals with a relatively tiny fraction of the things that make and keep us healthy. The rest of it, the things you mentioned, education, housing, safety, freedom from poverty, all of those sorts of things, that's really what health is all about. And you know, that concept has seemed like sort of interesting academic information. Well, COVID shined an enormous bright spotlight on that because while there's a bit of disparity in medical care that is racially and economically based in this country, that's nothing in comparison to the disparities around education, housing, all the other things I mentioned. And so the fact that African Americans are dying at a tenfold higher rate than Caucasians through COVID has very, very little to do with the medical care being delivered. I don't want to suggest it's completely equal because there's a little bit of disparity, but the real disparity is in the systemic racism that's based into our society and that's hardwired and affects every other aspect of life, which is that other 80 or 85%. And, you know, it's tragic that we're seeing it unfold, but it's wonderful that it can't be ignored anymore and it's front and center and in your face and probably the best opportunity we've had as a society in my professional lifetime to do something about it.
And at core, part of this is, and this is something we've seen Delaware dabble in a bit pre-pandemic, is this shift from fee-for-service to value-based care. Can you explain a little bit about what that means in this context and what role Nemours is playing or trying to play in making that kind of shift?
Right. So let me start with the big picture. So the U.S. health system is a $3.5 trillion enterprise. It's roughly a third of our gross domestic product. And virtually every dollar of that $3.5 trillion goes to pay for the opposite of what we're trying to get. What we're trying to get is health. We don't pay for health in this country. We pay for volume and complexity of medical service delivered, and we get it. So we have the highest volume and the highest complexity of medical care of any industrialized country on the planet, and our health outcomes are among the worst in almost every single category that you look at, whether that's infant mortality or treatment of chronic diseases or you know, pick a measure. We're at the bottom of almost all of them. We believe at Nemours, and I believe very strongly personally, that at the root of that problem is the financial incentives. And the minute we start paying our health system, our United States health system, for health, we're going to start to get it. And behaviors will radically change. And we will be falling over each other trying to invest in education, housing, and the things that actually impact health, because we'll have to do it to survive financially, where now any investment of a dollar in those things comes off the bottom line and comes away from medical care.
How does Nemours help push the ball in the right direction with that?
So Nemours is very invested in leading the charge of changing the definition of health in kids to health and not medical care. And you know, I'll say it plainly. We want to be at 100% full financial risk for the health of every child we care for as rapidly as possible. So that plays out differently with every payer, in every market, at every institution. So our strategy is what I just said. Our tactics or our behavior is adapted to each individual situation.
And I mentioned, you know, there have seen some initiatives here in Delaware, you know, connected to this focus on social determinants of health. And I'm curious if that is in any way part of the reason why you guys recently hired the state's Department of Health and Social Services Director, Dr. Kara Odom Walker, to join your Office of Policy and Prevention in D.C. Was that a factor in bringing her on board? And what are some of the things that she'll be working on as she moves into that office?
So I hired Kara Walker because of the person she is and the skill set she has, which is truly remarkable. Her connections with Delaware and her relationship with Delaware is a very, very important bonus, because Nemours is intensely invested in the future of kids in Delaware. And we see the state of Delaware as our partner in working with us to create what we're mutually interested in, which is Delaware's kids being the healthiest kids in the country and the healthiest kids anywhere on the planet. And because of the unique role Nemours has and plays in Delaware, we actually see that as achievable. And so having somebody of Dr. Walker's vision, expertise, collective experience in health systems, government, and academic institutions is a huge plus. The fact that Dr. Walker also knows how Delaware works and can help us understand and articulate what we're trying to get done in a positive way to the state and with the state is just a icing on the cake. It makes it even better.
I do want to kind of finish up on the big picture where we started. Mm-hmm. How does Nemours kind of move forward with its kind of overall mission over the next year or so until a vaccine for COVID is found or more better treatments are developed? Are there some key areas that you feel like as an operation you need to emphasize during that period of time in this new normal?
Yeah, to flip that question around, I'd say, you know, our biggest opportunity or challenge, if you want to frame it that way, is to not allow COVID to cause us to take our eye off the ball. We know what needs to happen in healthcare in this country for kids, and we know what role we need to play. That hasn't really changed at all with COVID. You know, COVID has changed the playing field a bit and it's changed some of the ground rules, but it hasn't changed what the right thing to do is, and it hasn't changed what the opportunity is. So, you know, what we need to do is be nimble and flexible and agile to adapt to this world that's going to be different in a month than it is now and different again in another month, but continue to pursue our objectives, which are bigger and broader than COVID will ever be.
But does it make it a lot harder, though, to do the kind of outreach? I mean, I guess what I think about is beyond the care, there's so much Nemours has done with things with in the areas of obesity, childhood obesity, even with things like dealing with concussions and youth sports. Yeah. Does that become much more difficult, at least short term, because of the restrictions that are involved?
I'm going to say no. I'm going to say in aggregate, COVID has made our job easier because we have big, aspirational, innovative ideas, and those are no longer background noise. Everything is on the table right now. So I didn't wish COVID would happen. I wish it didn't happen. It's tragic, but it's created a ton of opportunity for us, and we're going to be first at the table taking advantage of that.
Thanks to Nemours CEO, Dr. Larry Moss, for joining us on The Green this week. And that's all we have time for on this week's edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, you can also check out The Green via podcast at our website, on Apple Podcasts, and on the NPR One app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter, at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Support for The Green comes in part from the Delaware Alliance for Nonprofit Advancement. As a leader of the nonprofit sector, Dana is committed to strengthening, enhancing, and advancing Delaware nonprofits through low-cost training, consulting, research, and advocacy support for nonprofit leaders and board directors. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible, contributor Larry Nangest and Delaware Public Media's Sophia Schmidt. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us this week, and we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.